Hey, hey, welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We're up to episode 10, so throw the balloons in the air, pop the bubbly. I'm Scott Pianowski, your co-host today, and we have a great guest. You know, when they told me I could be using rotating guests for the show, I knew Chris List was going to be one of the guys I would send an early call to, and he answered the bat signal this week. You know him as the managing editor of RotoWire and one of the co-hosts, along with Jeff Erickson, of the RotoWire Fantasy Sports Today show on Sirius XM. It's 4 days a week, a great show. We're going to talk sports and baseball for about 35 minutes, and then we're going to transition to our draft. We're going to be drafting food today. A lot of things were in play with Chris, but I decided food would be a good way to go. He's a connoisseur of food, and I like to eat, so a lot of overlap with that. But before we get directly into baseball, I wanted to ask you, I heard on the radio today you were talking about a Kentucky Derby pool that you guys ran over at Sirius with your program, and obviously the first time in Kentucky Derby history. If you missed the news on Saturday, the winner of the race was disqualified and taken off the board. This is not uncommon in horse racing, but it's very uncommon in a Triple Crown race. It's never happened before in the Kentucky Derby where the person who won the race wasn't the official winner. And it kind of lines up with where we are in sports right now, where, you know, stuff is being reviewed, the change of replay rules in the NFL. It seems like these NBA games and NCAA basketball games have constant breakdowns because they have to see if something's going to be overturned and examine things. It's a big part of hockey as well. It's been all over the NHL playoffs. Where do you stand on just where replay culture is, and how did you feel about what they did Saturday in the race?
Well, it affected me personally because we did a Kentucky Derby draft on the show, and I had maximum security. Now, we thought this was kind of a stupid, harmless bet since none of us know anything about horse racing. So we were kind of making it a big joke, and I thought I had won $4 from each person, the other three guys in the draft. We did it like on a dollar basis times the odds. And okay, cool. I can like talk about it on Monday, gloat that I'm a genius and I know horse racing and I beat them. And then I see they got it reversed. Okay, this other Country House or whatever won it. Oh, one of the producers picked Country House. What do we owe him now? What? We owe him $65 each? Are you kidding me? I mean, come on, man. And that guy's cracking up. He won $200, you know, in like a totally nothing. It was supposed to be nothing. It was like $5 changing hands.
And did you watch this all in real time? Were you watching the race, or did you find out when everything was over?
No, I only found out when it was over. In fact, I thought I had won, and I was going to tweet something snarky, and then I was too lazy to do it, so I didn't. And then later on, I realized, wait, what? And then it took me a while before I actually put it together that, you know, we also paid for placing and showing, and I'm the only one who didn't have a place or a show. So I'm at like $80, you know, for like something that was a joke. So I'm a little bitter about it. But yeah, it kind of fed into the idea that you brought up, which is that with replay, you know, it happens in football, obviously basketball, and it's been a thing for a while, but, you know, foul call goes against your guy in the closing seconds, or pass interference penalty is or is not called. And, you know, the Dez Bryant catch rule thing where the Cowboys probably, they might not have beat the Packers, but they would have been up and would have come down to a final drive. We're just sort of in a culture where everything is litigated, every little thing. And I mean, this, you know, goes to politics too. Nobody can just accept the results of anything. You know, we've got to fight this tooth and nail. Somehow it's illegitimate. Everything's got to be fought tooth and nail in basically every aspect of the culture. And I get it. There's some positives. Like if there's some things are super cheap and unfair and you want to revisit them, but I think like we've erred too far in the other direction. And, you know, there are a lot of examples, like the catch rule was egregious. They somewhat fixed it last year, but the idea that once you were able to review a catch, then you needed a criteria to review a catch, because you can't just review a catch and just say, hey, it doesn't look like a catch, or it does. You have to have a basis for the review. So once you had a basis for the review, then you had to create all these like parts of a catch, like he has to have control or make a football move and all this nonsense that really is just made up of whole cloth. And when you're playing football in the park, when you're a kid, you kind of just know a catch when you see it, and you might argue about a close call, but you make a decision, you move on. And because we have replay, because, you know, we're so litigious and so argumentative, it's like we trust nothing. And therefore, everything is subject to review. And the deeper you dig, there's always something a little untoward that you can find, a little push here, a little shove there, a little PI that wasn't called in every single play. And it just makes things a lot less satisfying. You know, I kind of miss the days of in the 80s when the Bears would win the Super Bowl by 50 and you'd be like, okay, that was the best team. Or the Niners would win by 50. It was a terrible Super Bowl, but at least, you know, there wasn't this like haggling over, you know, this and that penalty call.
Yeah, the thing with review with me is I want egregious things, horrible calls to be fixed, but I want to be done expediently. And I think the problem for me with replay is that if you can't, sometimes there was an NCAA game where there was a delay of like 5 or 6 minutes. They're trying to figure something out. And I'm like, hey, if you can't figure it out in 90 seconds or 2 minutes, just move on and live with the play as called. The problem with me is when we have these long reviews and you see the debate on Twitter and people can't seem to agree. It's like, okay, there's no consensus here. Nobody has seen the definitive shot. At some point, you have to go back to the game. And then you just lose the moment of the game, the excitement of the game. If it's just going to be, okay, a play happened, now let's just throw it in the lab and have people look at it from 20 different angles at 10 different speeds. That's what I'm against. Replay to me should take, for example, if you were able to replay that play in the Saints-Rams game, the pass interference that wasn't called, if they had replayed that, I would think for 30 seconds or a minute, they could immediately say, wow, this is terrible. We got to fix it. Boom, let's just move on. But once they haven't, there should be a clock on the replay. And if they can't figure it out in a really expedient time, just move on.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. The problem, though, with PI, it's always been like all these random things are reviewable, but PI is not reviewable. PI's games obviously turn on PI all the time. In that particular example, you know, that sent one team to the Super Bowl, basically. I mean, it's as big as it could get, and they can't review it. But if PI becomes reviewable, that's also a huge headache. Because, you know, every time the ball's up in the air, there's some contact usually between defender and receiver. And at some point, we just have to trust the refs. You know, at some point, we just say, okay, you made the call. And yeah, it's just a big can of worms. And I think your idea is good. I think there should be 30 seconds. Otherwise, the play stands. But why would the team that challenged get penalized because the refs are too slow to make a decision?
I also worry with pass interference and with opening up the challenges in the NFL that what's going to happen is when teams have challenges late in the game and they're desperate, they're just going to challenge anything and it's going to, you know, block up the game a little bit. Of course, they still have a limited amount of challenges. I think it's good that they challenge all the turnovers. It seems like they get those pretty quickly, the change of possession and all that, but in the scoring plays. But those are, again, usually scoring plays are confirmed pretty quickly. What we don't need is gaps. And if you're going to give us a gap, if something is going to be a long wait, then get the commercials out of the way, right? I mean, the worst thing is just sitting there and living through that, all that. You know, I just want the ball back in play as quickly as possible.
Here's what we should do. If you're a coach and you challenge a play that's deemed frivolous or it's not even close, you should get an electric shock. And if you're a ref and you take more than a minute or you, you know, uphold the wrong play or you, you know, miss a bad pass interference, you get some sort of electric shock. And then, you know, just put some skin in the game here because it's just, you know, it's tough on the viewer and it's going the wrong direction. But the problem is technology is just giving us more information. You know, if you can't put the genie back in the bottle, you can't pretend it's 1977 and we'll just move on when the replay is being shown from eight angles and people are going ballistic on Twitter and they know the call was wrong.
When you talk about it's not 1977 anymore, and let's spin that to today and to fantasy baseball. And we're at a point we've never had more stats and more advanced stats and more analytics. And we have exit velocity, we have barrels, we have spin rate, we have launch angle. And I wonder if some of this stuff has gone a little bit too far for a couple of things. One, we don't know sometimes what's predictive and what's descriptive. We don't know how to use some of these stats. And maybe you can just get where you need to go with the walks and the strikeouts and the stats, the secondary stats. We're not talking about necessarily the most basic of stats. I mean, nobody's using batting average anymore and trying to say this makes somebody good or, you know, people aren't winning MVPs on their RBI count anymore. We can think past that. But I wonder, have we gone too far? Is the genie too far out of the bottle with some of these advanced stats? And what are the stats that are on Chris List's computer when you're trying to analyze trades, pickups, your teams? And what are you using these days?
You know, I look at all this stuff. I'll look at exit velocity. I'll look at people are into like swinging strike rate. The dumbest thing is first pitch strike rate. That's like honestly the dumbest stat of all time. It's like, okay, so we know a guy had 200 strikeouts and we know another guy had 200 strikeouts, but one guy threw more first pitch strikes. Well, that just means the guy who threw fewer first pitch strikes threw more strikes on subsequent pitches. Why would one be an indicator rather than another? We know the result. Now, if you knew nothing else, if we didn't know the result, then of course, whoever throws the first pitch strike is going to have an advantage. But we know the result. We know the outcome. It's like so absurd that we're even looking at this kind of stuff. So people are, I think, off base sometimes in digging for stuff that logically has no basis. I think some of the exit velocity stuff is valid. Like it's showing a more real sense of what's going on the field that's not dependent on, you know, luck, where the fielder was, you know, a great play by a defender, the angle at which the ball is hit. It just simply shows, you know, how good the quality of contact was. And I think that's useful. But I think that that's usually, at least over a decent sized sample, and I even mean like 1 month, reflected in the cosmetic stats. How many home runs does he have? You know, what's his batting average? What's his BABIP? Is the guy ripping the ball or not? And, you know, I think maybe there's some outliers where some guy's crushing the ball and he just has this really uncanny amount of bad luck where it's just everything he's hit is to the deepest part of the particular park he happens to be playing in, or it's guys are making amazing catches on him. But that's really, to me, the much smaller variable of the two when you're saying, well, what's the variance of a guy's season? One is, you know, how's he playing? How's he seeing the ball? How's he hitting the ball? And the other is the luck factor. So I think usually when a guy's hitting well, it's reflected in all his stats, you know, all the advanced stats, all the basic stats. And you might get a little tiny bit of information with the advanced stats, but I think strikeouts and walks and, you know, home runs allowed and hits allowed and things like that are still, you know, get you 97% of the way there.
Yeah, I like to think that Occam's razor approach as well. We're taping this podcast, and this is the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball podcast, on Monday, May 6th. And I don't know if we can play the it's early card anymore. I don't know exactly when that flips from, oh, who cares? It's April 10th. It's April 15th, whatever. I have some teams right now doing really well, and I'm convinced, maybe this is confirmation bias now, I'm convinced those teams are in it for the long haul. I'm in last place in the Tout Mixed League, and I don't know what would have to go right, how many green lights I'd need to hit, how many lottery tickets I'd need to scratch to come up winners to fix that team, even though I'm engaged, I'm doing fab, I've made some trades, whatever. But when is it a bad start, maybe a bad season? When is a good start a good season? And how do you feel about your outlier teams for the good or the bad, what their ultimate fate may be?
Well, you know, you said you were having kind of a tough season, but compared to me, you're the 2018 Red Sox. I'm having, by far, my teams are, if you looked at what place they're all in, by far the worst ever in any point in the last 20 years. And I'm not sure why. I still like them. I still like my players on most of them. I look at my team, I'm like, this is a great team. But why is it 50 RBIs out of fourth place? Why is it 60 runs out of fourth place? You know, well, I can go through each player why it's 50 runs out of fourth place. But at a certain point, and it's only May, sure, I think Jose Ramirez and Chris Bryant and Yasiel Puig are all going to hit. I really do. I think Miguel Cabrera even probably is going to hit. Corey Seager, Justin Turner, I think all those guys are going to hit. But even if they start hitting now, it's not like the other teams are going to stop adding on more stats. And I have to make up a ridiculous amount of deficit. And I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. I know it's only May, and I do expect better days ahead. But I think the hole is too deep. And unless my team is so good, unless it's such an amazing team that over the last 5 months, I absolutely destroy everybody, I'm not going to get there. I'm going to still make my moves. I'm curious to see this play out. I'd love to be proven wrong, but the math is the math, man. It's just hard to make up that kind of deficit. And some of it's errors on my part. Some of it's bad luck. I haven't had that many injuries. I'm not actually, I think I may even have above average injury luck, at least average. Certainly I see guys going down every day, and not that many of them are on my team. So I don't know why I'm having an awful year, but I think by May, a couple of the teams will rebound, but a couple of them, man, just like what you're saying about Tout, it's like it would have to be just an absolutely monstrous run by three or four players simultaneously.
I know you've said before that you don't have, I don't believe, any Bellinger or any Yelich. I'm curious if you have any Tyler Glass now, who right now is
no.
The right answer
no.
On the pitching side. Could we have seen this coming? Do you have any Matt Boyd?
No. Domingo Germán, no. He's 6 wins for Domingo Germán. No, none of those guys.
Caleb Smith?
No, 0. I have 7 leagues. Okay, I mean, just by luck, I should have some of those guys.
What could we have done differently? If you could just go back in March, and maybe you didn't know the specific names, but I mean, what is this? Can you pinpoint a mistake? I said you. I think you said earlier you weren't really sure why your teams weren't doing that well. Maybe it's time to let go of Yasiel Puig, but that's just one guy. I mean,
I think Puig's going to crush it. I think it's just cold weather. He starts slow sometimes. I think he's going to be huge in the summer, but yeah, he's obviously one of the reasons the teams aren't doing well. No, I wish I had taken Tyler Glass now. I like Tyler Glass now, but I just didn't like him enough to keep pushing him up. There were some guys like Glass now who was getting a lot of helium, and there were guys like, you know, some of them I I didn't draft any Garrett Hampson. I wanted Garrett Hampson. I thought this guy would surprise nobody if this guy was a second round pick next year. And so I wanted to share, but he's going in like the 11th, 12th round without a job. And so I just kept missing him. I was like, damn, I can't believe he's gone. And there were a lot of players like that. Glasnow, I can't remember where he went in the end. I thought people were pushing him up. They were making sort of the Blake Snell case, like another guy in Tampa and, you know, the same situation. And I was like, yeah, there's two different people. And it is like Blake Snell last year. I mean, it was totally right. So, I did one thing that was different than most people, and I was pretty dogmatic about it, was I did not draft pitching in rounds 4 through 10. I was like, you know what? Historically, I want an ace or two, and then I'll wait and just gamble on random pitchers doing well. That tier typically is the worst return on investment historically. And so I don't have, and Glasnow went in that tier. I thought he was beyond 10th initially, but he definitely went in that tier. Luis Castillo was sort of the tail end of that tier. I'm trying to think a few other guys that were in there. Clevinger was before he got hurt. And yeah, there's a few guys that, you know, that are just crushing it. And some of the aces that I have are not. And so I think the aces will still end up being worth taking. I think, you know, the Garrett Coles and Scherzers and most of them, Verlander, they're all going to be, yeah, you're glad you took them where you did. But we'll see about those other guys where they sustain the performance. But if they do, I'm going to have trouble. That you need some of those huge, huge gainers. And as I said, I don't have any of them.
Do you feel like the hit rate for the aces is about what do we expect? I mean, for as great as Verlander has been or as great as Cole has been, you know, Kluber's had a bad push and now he's hurt. Snell's had his ups and downs. Nola hasn't pitched well. The Mets pitchers have been disappointing for different reasons. Carrasco's had a couple of bad outings. Looks like Bauer's taking a step up in class. Did you think that group through 5 weeks, whatever that means, would be more reliable than spin, or this is about what we should expect?
So if you look at strikeouts, it's about what we should expect. If you look at ERA, it's way worse than what you'd expect because all those guys like Carrasco and Scherzer and even Cole had a huge shelling and their ERAs are bad. Scherzer's like 4 or something like that. So it's worse because you've had your busts. You've had your Syndergaards, although you had a monster start last time out. You've had your Syndergaards and, you know, and Kluber's obviously hurt, but he's doing badly and Sale's doing badly. You have like all those guys who have struggled. And then even the guys who have done well, strikeout to walk wise, like Cole and Scherzer are not doing well wins wise or ERA wise. So they've actually earned less value than you'd expect. But if you look at strikeouts and walks, sort of the basic stats that are more predictive, you know, it's sort of what you would expect with a couple of busts.
Is there anything that we can do differently or just do you keep your head down and grind and do what you normally do?
I think it's the latter. I was toying with the idea of starting more middle relievers because I thought, oh, we're in this insane home run era. And 2 years ago, I did some math on one of my 12-team NFBC leagues. And the streamers, the guys that were not drafted, that, you know, their stats were horrible. They were like a 4.6 ERA and a 1.36 whip. And remember, these are from a 12 team, which is always good options to stream. And no one's streaming against the Yankees in Yankee Stadium or the Red Sox at Fenway. I mean, people are streaming against the league's weakest teams. And even with that, it was a 4.60 ERA, 1.36 whip. And I thought, okay, when there's a crazy juiced ball era, stay away from the streamers and get more Andrew Millers or Dylan Betances back then. And this year, you know, you got to find those guys, whoever the new version of that is. But I'm not so sure for a couple of reasons that works. One is a couple of those middle relievers just got absolutely bombed. They're giving up 4 and 5 runs themselves. And secondly, I don't know, everything's different. Every year is a little different. You know, you could say, well, it's like 2017, so let's do what would have worked in 2017. But, you know, maybe the composition of why, you know, Sarah's had a pretty good article on The Athletic of maybe why things are different this year and just makes you, I think, kind of grind and, you know, be judicious. But I still agree, like, if you got a marginal guy with 2 starts and they're, you know, not great starts, don't do it. Just put in, you know, Julio Urias or someone like that that can, you know, is pretty stable type of guy.
Yeah, I like using middle relievers. The only thing that's frustrating about them is when they have a bad outing, it seems like they allow 4 or 5 runs. I have a lot of Nick Anderson, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. Like, wow, he's got 17 strikeouts for me in 8 innings. This is just what I wanted. And then he goes out and allows a couple of hits, ends up allowing a 3-run home run or a grand slam or something like that. You just see that outing. You look at your team, you think, I thought I did pretty well today. What's wrong with my ERA? Oh, okay, that's what happened. So those guys are great. And look, I get it. You have to take the good with the bad. But it feels like when those guys go bad, it's the 4 or 5 runs they go bad.
it's just senseless. You know, you put them in for, you know, sort of safety, and then they do that. It's truly horrible. I picked up this guy in tout, this guy, like, can't remember his name, JB Wendell something. He's a reliever.
Yeah, Oakland reliever. Yeah.
And he had been good. And I just, you know, I had a lot of injured guys. So I just was like, you can put that swing spot and get an extra pitcher in there if you want. I was like, may as well just put in a cheap pitcher to get me some extra stats of some kind while, you know, I'm waiting for Clint Frazier to come back and Austin Meadows. And the guy gives up six runs. It was two different outings, two three-run outings. It's like, dude, I just put you in just to, like, get me four strikeouts and, like, a two ERA, you know, and now you just blew up my ERA. I wouldn't even picked him up. You know, I didn't need to put someone in. It was just, it's just sort of like, all right, he's harmless. He's doing well. His K to walk is good. He's a reliever in Oakland. It's a good park, and just completely imploded.
Yeah, it seemed like a logical play at the time. And, you know, some of those are going to go bad. I know one path to your team's improving that I don't have is I don't have any Vladimir Guerrero Jr. I don't have any Nick Senzel. And I'm pretty sure you have shares of both of those guys. Vlad hasn't started to hit yet. I think everybody expects that he will. Senzel hit a couple of home runs earlier before our taping on Monday. He's stolen a base already. He had a home run taken away, or extra base hit anyway, taken away by Kevin Pillar. So it seems like he's kind of marking his territory. What are you expecting from Senzel and Guerrero the rest of the way?
Yeah, two more homers for Senzel today. And Guerrero's been not very good, but I expect them both to rake. There's a guy who's in the industry named Matt Modica, and he does a lot of NFBC, and he's just, like, insanely aggressive on these young guys. Like how I used to be before, I was like, this is crazy. I've got too many busts. And he just paid up for everybody. And his philosophy was that the game has changed, that, you know, it's really a young person's game, both for, you know, salary reasons and arbitration reasons and collective bargaining reasons. And these guys just seem more pro ready than ever. And, you know, peak age is like 23, 24, not 27 anymore. And everything's kind of moving up. And so you should snag as many of these guys as possible. And, you know, I think we do need to be judicious between, you know, who's just a decent prospect. You know, Carter Kieboom gets called up, and maybe he'll be great in a year or whatever, but, you know, we can't treat everybody like they're going to be the guy or the next Juan Soto. But at the same time, there's only so many of those guys. And if you get a chance to grab one, it's kind of like, you know, if a veteran is just way outperforming his historical production, sometimes you got to just pounce and do it. And sometimes pouncing, in the case of these, you know, hyped rookies, is in March.
What do you think the odds are that Senzel ends up having a better season than Guerrero?
He's got a little head start. I'd say it's like 55-45 Guerrero, but it's pretty close. I mean, you know, Senzel's got a way better lineup and a good park, and he's obviously in a nice groove now. I think it's pretty close to 50-50. What do you think?
Maybe a little less pressure on him too. I mean, Guerrero, you know, his father was a Hall of Famer, and we waited so long for Guerrero because he could have come up at any point last year, and then the Jays just played the manipulation game. Of course, they've been doing the same thing with Senzel. They wanted him to learn a new position, so at least they had a just reason to send him down to the minors for a little bit. But I wonder if maybe Guerrero's been pressing. And the thing that surprised me with Guerrero is that he struck out as much as he has. Again, we're talking about a week, you know, maybe eight games of samples. But I thought he wasn't going to strike out hardly at all because he never did in the minors. And how much better could the stuff really be in the majors? But I'm surprised he struck out as much as he has. The thing that kills me about Senzel is that Guerrero I don't have because you had to buy in at the expectation that he would just hit the ground to be a star immediately. You did not have to do that with Senzel. You got him at a reasonable stash price. I defend my stance of not taking Guerrero over Anthony Rendon or somebody like that. You know, if it was a third, fourth, fifth round pick, that was too early for me. But I'm kicking myself for having no Senzel.
Yeah, I didn't get Senzel like the 13th, though, 12th or 13th, once we got into like deep into March. People were starting to, they said he might open as a starting center fielder. I think that bumped his stock. But I hear you. It's 13th is very different than a fourth or after he got hurt, like a sixth.
Now you live, I believe, what, full-time or close to full-time now in Portugal. And although you will be in Los Angeles at some point during the summer, talk about how that changes just the cadence of your day, how you consume your baseball, you know, how you do your fab bidding. Are you watching less or more baseball than you used to? And do you think that affects your just ability to put your best fantasy foot forward? How different is it, the fantasy experience, the baseball experience in Portugal?
I think it's better and it helps me. And I know that how my teams are doing so far is not really good evidence of that, but first of all, the main slate of games, the 7 p.m. Eastern games, start at midnight. And that's just a great time for the games to start because I got a 7-year-old daughter. She's fast asleep. You know, it's just kind of my time that I have completely by myself to get stuff done. So that's a great time to start. You know, L.A. is the worst. It's 4 o'clock. The lineup locks, it's like, it's a pain. And I assume the East Coast is like, you know, 4 o'clock, I used to go out and like get Sasha from school, from her nursery school. It was like, you know, I'm like in the car, I'm like trying to set stuff before going. It was horrible. And then obviously the East Coast, people are eating dinner, but here it's good. So I think it helps. I typically, you know, when there's day games, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, Sundays, I have the MLB package. It's actually super cheap. And I don't have to buy any sort of, well, I guess you can get the MLB package online in the US now, but I've got the football package too without DirecTV, which is really nice. But anyway, I can watch all, I can just, you know, launch it on my TV. I can, you know, I've got the app on my Apple TV and I can do it on my computers and I'll just watch, you know, I'll have it on in the background sometimes. And then like at night when I'm setting my lineups, I'll just watch it till like 1 a.m., 1:30. Usually, hopefully I can like get away from it and go to sleep and not stay up till 2:30 if one of my pitchers is going or bases are loaded and he's walking people and I'm torturing myself by watching it. So I think it's great. It's actually easier here. And I actually struggle in the summer when I go back to LA and I get sort of off my routine.
At least though in LA, you get, you know, West Coast time, you get the easy conclusion of games. I have to make a business decision every week, every night, really. Do I want to stay with this? You know, this hockey game's going to overtime. Do I want to get invested in it and put off my sleep by potentially an hour or so? You know, I watched the entire Portland-Denver game three, that game that went four overtimes. And, you know, I didn't go to bed till 3 a.m. because that's when the game ended at 2:30 or something like that. And then I was so hyped up from the game and I didn't even have a stake in it. But the choices I have to make. You know, just talking about the NBA, it makes me think of something. I when I watched Golden State and Houston play, especially Houston, you know, where so much of it is just relying on what Harden's really good at doing, you know, the isolation and the committing contact, but you get the foul call, and they've optimized their offense to the point that it's really good for them, but I don't think it's good for the league. I don't enjoy watching it. I think a lot of people share that idea, and it reminds me in a loose sense of what the New Jersey Devils did in the NHL in the late 90s, mid 90s, early 2000s, where they went to the neutral zone trap and they really bottlenecked a lot of the beauty out of hockey. And they played the style really well. They had a great goalie. They're a very disciplined team. They won some Stanley Cups. Houston, of course, has been successful. This team hasn't won a championship, but they could. I mean, I think there's good chances just about anybody. How do we reconcile the idea? And, you know, look at where baseball is. It's all home runs and strikeouts, and, you know, with some walks sprinkled in. The singles is going out the window. Stolen bases are just not worth it anymore. Teams are starting to figure that out. How do we reconcile the fact that the optimized version of sports may not be best for the fan experience?
Right. It's, you know, people say analytics are killing the game, and all the analytics guys are like, that's ridiculous. It's clear that, you know, players are better now and they're more efficient and whatever, but they're talking past each other because what's optimal, as you just pointed out, for winning or for a particular team's, you know, winning percentage or success rate is not necessarily optimal as a product for the fans. And when you optimize for one variable, you often get suboptimal other variables. And what's also individually optimal may not be collectively optimal, because what's collectively optimal, obviously, for the game is more revenue, more fans, more enjoyment, more attention to it. And so you may be sort of optimizing yourself out. I mean, this happens in business. You know, they optimize for shareholder returns. They don't optimize for environmental impact or long-term having many diverse businesses. We have these gigantic behemoths like Amazon that own everything. You know, it's like, is that long-term what we want for everything to be sold by one company? Things that are optimal in the short term and first order effects are not, the second order effect may be bad. And so I do think we have an issue. You know, they drew the 3-point line in and the 80s, early 80s, and finally about 30 years later, they realized, oh, why are we ever taking a 2-point, you know, jump shot? Why? It's either dunks or threes, and that's changing the game. And Harden is figuring out, you know, how to take a foul every time and make, you know, that rule pay off for them. It was kind of like Peyton Manning used to snap the ball when the 12th guy had his foot still on the field, and the announcers would be like, oh, that's just brilliant. So brilliant taking advantage of that. It's like, yeah, I guess that's an optimal thing to do, but like, okay, whistle, penalty, cheap 5 yards that doesn't affect the play. And so I think the leagues, I think they're probably going to wake up a little bit to it or wise up to it, and maybe they won't, but that the analytics has now changed the game to the point where maybe the leagues need to make some changes, which of course have unintended effects, you know, third level effects that who knows what the next adaptation will be, but that, you know, it's kind of getting away from them. And you know, you got to be very careful about changing rules because, again, it could be 10 times worse. But we're at a point where they've sort of optimized it to, you know, to, as you said, an unaesthetic, ugly, and unsatisfying product.
another optimization thing that smart teams do with the schedule is they say, okay, we're on the road. We have this back-to-back. I'm going to rest my star on the second game of that back-to-back. Perfectly reasonable from the team point of view. But you look at the fan experience. Maybe they're going to a city in a different conference. It's their only visit there. So, you know, somebody's gone to that game because they want to see Steph Curry or they want to see LeBron, whoever it is, and they're not playing because the team is doing what's perfectly reasonable from the team perspective, but then it hurts the fan experience. I think the NBA, I've made this prediction. I don't know it will happen anytime soon, but I think all the sports leagues have played too many games, especially hockey, basketball, and baseball. And I think if there's one league that might be proactive enough to say, you know what, let's cut back on the regular season a little bit, maybe even tweak the playoffs a little bit. We'll give a little bit of money up. The players will have to take less money. The owners will have to take more revenue, but it will be a better experience. I think you could sell the players on, you're going to make a little less money, but you're going to play 12 less games a season, 15 less games a season. I think players might sign off for that.
Oh yeah. It should be 50, 60 games a season. I mean, but it's just going to, it'll cost them a lot of revenue and a lot of TV revenue. And yeah, again, you optimize for short-term TV revenue. You pack as many games into a season as you possibly can. But how about having Tracy McGrady play 15 years at his peak? You know, how about Tim Duncan not have to sit out, you know, 20 games a year or play 15 minutes in 20, 30 games a year for the last 8 years of his career? All of these things might have been different if they gave these guys a break. And the quality of play might be higher. You mentioned, you know, guys, people, fans showing up to see a star player and he's not even in the lineup that night. All that. I think the playoffs are a joke. More than half the teams make a playoffs, and it's a seven-game series in round one. Really, we need to see seven games. First of all, seven games, not only is it boring, but it makes it almost impossible for there to be an upset. How's the eight going to beat the one in a seven-game series? I almost think like the top four teams should get a bye, and the next eight should play like a single-game college basketball style, you know, just like one and done or something, you know, they can just make it so much more interesting and so much less taxing, but it's just such a grind. It goes all the way into June. And it's hard on these guys. And if you're a freak like LeBron James, he's the Nolan Ryan of basketball, basically. You can hold up, but most of the guys can't. And there's just so many stars whose careers have been compromised and cut short, or they end up doing the managed Tim Duncan way for the last 5 or 10 years.
Speaking of optimization, have you been following at all the reigning Jeopardy champion? I think his name is James Holzhauer, professional gambler who's just winning money hand over fist. And I don't know that he'll win as many games as Ken Jennings ultimately won, but it seems like his rate of winning is a lot higher than Jennings's, and he's a good chance to pass Jennings on the dollar amount won. I guess Jeopardy's on a 2-week teacher tournament hiatus, so we won't see him back in play. I'm not really a Jeopardy guy. I'm good in a few trivia areas. I'm good at sports. I'm good at music. There's a ton of things I don't know anything about. So if you have me on your trivia team, you're just hoping I get a few questions in my areas of expertise. But I'm curious if you're following the Jeopardy story and what you think of it.
I'm not really following it. Dalton Del Don mentioned it on the Real Man Wood podcast and asked me about it and told me that the guy was like crushing what Ken Jennings was doing in terms of like nightly earnings and the total scores that he was racking up. And that he was, what was he, like a poker player or something? He was a
professional gambler.
Professional
sports gambler.
Lives
in Las Vegas.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool, but I haven't really followed it beyond that.
Yeah, two things that he's doing is he's going, when he goes to the board, rather than usually people will pick a category they like and just go A to Z, you know, low to high, he's jumping all over the board and he's trying to find the daily doubles. And when he gets a daily double, he bets really big. And this is something I've known all along with Jeopardy. You know, again, I don't have the trivia chops to be on the show, but I've always thought people play it too conservatively because they want, it's like the blackjack player. It's like, oh, I don't want to hit 15 against a king. I might bust. I might be out of the hand. So they want to keep themselves involved and alive, even if maybe the dealer has a 9 or a 10 up and you've already lost. I mean, the book, the odds say that you should hit in that situation. But I think a lot of people, when they get an opportunity to bet big, these people know this stuff anyway. They're so good at trivia. That's how they get on the show. And then they get to the point where they can make a big bet and they're afraid to do it.
Right. I mean, he's probably figured out the odds that a random, you know, daily double that he gets it right. It might be like 85%. So like, what are you betting? You don't bet like every cent you know, if you had an 85%, like how much money would you bet if you had an 85% coin flip? You know, like it's a one shot deal, 85 you win, 15 you lose. How much money would you bet on that? You wouldn't bet all your money because 15% could happen. You might, but I think it would be a mistake. But you only got one shot at it though. How much would you bet?
Well, it's always like those funky questions, like say somebody offered you life-changing money. Say you won some raffle where you won $5 million and then you had a chance to flip a coin. And if you got the coin flip right, they would up it to $25 million or you'd get nothing. Now, with me, because $5 million would change my life, I'd have to, if I couldn't hedge that in any way, I'd have to pass on the upside of $25 million, because not only would $5 million change my life, but giving up that $5 million in an attempt to be greedy and losing it would probably ruin my life. But I mean, but somebody might say, no, that's totally wrong. Look at all the EV you're flushing. You should, you know, if you were, if a rich man was given that choice, he would probably take the $25 million option. Because they don't, the $5 million loss isn't going to be a big deal to them. This is why when those, like Aaron Nola signed a big contract, he's a pitcher. He could blow out his elbow tomorrow. Why? I would never say no to that first fortune. Obviously, everybody has to decide for themselves. But, I mean, you know, if I were in his situation, I know some guys didn't get great contracts. Albies, it sounds like, got underpaid. But, you know, maybe they have situations where their family is living in poverty, or they have people who need to be taken care of who don't have to wait 4 or 5 more years before they make the really big money.
Now, totally from an individual standpoint, that makes perfect sense. It's just idiotic that the Players Association hasn't figured out some sort of insurance system where the veterans pay 10% of their, you know, like the veterans get paid more on the way up and they pay some percentage in that every guy gets paid. They basically effectively up the minimum wage to $2 or $3 million a year. So you can just wait and get the EV payoff that you need and deserve, right? Like, why are they sacrificing all this value to owners? Why are you giving up so much EV to these owners who, you know, who can, you know, make the gamble and have the money, because you're just not willing to organize collectively. You know, if the Players Association were sort of unified, they would never take that. They'd be like, oh yeah, Albies, he's not making the league minimum. The league, you know, we'll make sure he makes $3 million a year and be based on merit or something like that. And that extra money that he's getting paid, like that will just come out of his long-term earnings, or it'll come, you know, it would just be sort of like he'd have to give some of that back later. And collectively, some guys would never make more later, but enough guys would make way more later that it would pay for it. They could figure out the math behind it, but they're just not doing that because they're not organized and they're sort of all out for themselves. And so they're, you know, they end up having to, they have to do the deal. And I agree with you. I mean, if there is no system, no insurance in place that you can, you know, reliably call on, and you know, you have a grandparent that might not make it a few years, yeah, you're going to take the money. And the teams know that, and they're being smart and they're exploiting that. But the players could organize and fix this, but they just haven't.
Right. I mean, you know, the best time for players as far as optimizing their side of it has always been they had really strong labor union ownership or leadership, I should say, and they haven't had that for a while. God knows the NFL needs that. You're listening to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm Scott Pianowski with our guest, Chris Liss, and we have completed the sports part of the program. So if you're only here for the sports today, you're free to walk the dog or go on to maybe iTunes and rate and review our podcast. Tell us how much you liked it. Give us some feedback. You can always get me on Twitter. It's Scott_Pianowski. It's time for our 5-round draft. And as I said earlier, Chris and I are going to be drafting food. And because Chris is an international man of mystery, I'm going to give him the first pick in our draft.
Well, so, you know, you said it's going to be more specific than, like, say, Chinese food. It'll be a little bit more specific than that. And so I actually prepared for this. This is the only thing I really prepared for because I wanted to have a good list. But part of the reason I'm going to take this first overall pick is that I want to make sure you don't take it. I have some other things that I don't think you'll take. So this is partly strategic. So with the first pick, and I don't know how specific you want me to be, but I'm going to take tacos with the first pick. I could take water, obviously, and then just have you die off within a few days. But I'm going to take salt.
No beverages, food only, no drinks.
Oh, okay, okay. I'll take tacos. I think that A, there's some risk that you would take it relatively early, and B, I really love good tacos. I don't mind Tex-Mex tacos. I'll eat them. They're fine. But, you know, I'm talking about the real Mexican style with the soft tortillas, the al pastor, the chicharrones, the spicy ones, cochinita pibil, shrimp tacos, even carne asada. It's a little bland, but I'll eat that too. Al pastor is probably my favorite. So I'm going tacos with the first pick.
Did you have a go-to taco place in LA?
Yes, a couple of places. And just luckily in Lisbon, these guys, one of them's from El Paso, he actually comped my birthday dinner the other day. So I'm gonna give him a plug.
Oh, right. Happy birthday. I think Friday was your birthday,
yeah,
right? Meant to send you a note. Happy birthday belatedly.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Appreciate it. I went to this place called Pistola y Corazon. It's a Mexican place that Sasha, my daughter, just loves. And she insisted we go there, even though it's my birthday. She got to choose. Heather was out of town, so it was just us two. And I told the guy who runs it that it was my birthday, and instead of a check, I got a zero and a happy birthday. So I'll mention him. This place is, like, you know, world class. Like, it's in Lisbon, which is totally random. It's nowhere near Mexico, but this place would do well in LA. That's how good it is.
Good stuff. I should also mention, by the way, one of the reasons we're doing food is because I've actually eaten at Chris's house before. He's entertained some Yahoo guys in the past. adult beverages, smoked meats, and you know, he's a really good cook. So if you get to be friendly with Chris, make sure you con him into cooking you dinner some night. It will be worth your while. My first pick is going to be steak. And it's really kind of odd to pick steak because I'm late to the steak game. My parents, my mom was a really good cook in a lot of ways, but for some reason they didn't make steak the way I would like it as a kid. They would make it really tough and leathery. And I grew up my whole life thinking I didn't like steak. And then one night I was out with a girlfriend of mine. I had gotten a non-steak item at a steakhouse. I was eating something else and she got a steak and she said, "You should really try this. I bet you'd love it." I said, "No, I don't like steak." And she gave me a piece of it. I'm like, "Oh my God, this is unbelievable." I think I ate half of her steak, which is probably why the relationship didn't work out. But hey, you know, lost the girl, gained the steak, a deliciously cooked steak. You know, I like fillets. I like New York strips. I like porterhouse. I like all sorts of steaks. I'm not really a prime rib guy. I know I've eaten steak in Chris's presence before. I've even been around you when you and Stopa made a steak bet in the Vegas League. That was a lot of fun. So if I'm going out for an expensive dinner, especially on somebody else's dime, I'm usually getting a steak.
All right. Well, then I guess in the second round, I'm going to take the next best thing to steak, and it's probably equal, which is a rack of lamb. I really like rack of lamb, especially if the fat is on the end of it and tastes like, you know, usually it's very, it's not chewy, it's soft, and it's sort of like butter. And same thing, you can make it medium rare. One thing that people don't realize about lamb is there's a lot of factory farmed meat in the U.S., which I think some of it tastes good if it's, you know, prime meat, but I would like to avoid it for a number of reasons. And usually lamb doesn't really, I don't think lamb really does well in a factory. I think they have to be out in the pasture eating the grass, which makes it quite a bit healthier. So lamb is always a good, if you're not sure about the quality of the place, go lamb over steak. So I'll take lamb in the second round.
No, that's a great pick. I can't go wrong with meat. I'm an unapologetic carnivore over here. My second pick is going to be one of the safest things you could ever get for a group of people, especially your kids are involved. It's pizza. I mean, is there any other food that everybody likes? You know, because look, there's vegetarians. They may not like meat. I know some people who don't like all certain kinds of ethnic food for different reasons. It doesn't agree with them. They had a bad experience with it, whatever. They don't like the way it's prepared. You go pizza. There's a pizza to satisfy everybody. I've never met the person who said, "Nah, not really into pizza." Maybe you have to need to find the right topping they like. I found out later in life that I prefer my pizza a little bit on the well-done side with the cheese a little bit burnt. It's a simple thing. You can make homemade pizza. It's delicious. You can grill pizza. It's great. I prefer thin crust to thick crust, but you know, sometimes a deep dish pizza really hits the spot. You can't go wrong with pizza.
I can't argue with it. I'm gluten-free, so I eat gluten-free pizza, which is not as good as the real deal. And so you pick something that you probably could have waited on, but I hear you out of principle. I don't know how much you're picking to accumulate a winning team, or you're just going straight from the heart and you're not.
I knew I couldn't wait on steak. I knew I had to pick steak first. Other than that, I just have a random list of things.
Okay. Well, I'll keep going. And it'll get more specific, but I actually, when I'm in LA, there's this farmer's market near Culver City, and there's this Italian guy who's like the seafood guy. And so whenever I'm in town, I always go to him. It's expensive, but I get this really thick cut of salmon, you know, and it's like the center cut, and it's maybe 3.5-4 inches thick at the highest part. And I put it on the grill. It's wild Alaskan salmon. Don't eat the farmed crap. It's not good for you. It's not as tasty either. And I just marinated just quickly in olive oil and salt. That's it. Throw it on the grill. I've gotten really good at just timing exactly how long it takes, just instinct, so that the middle is still red and sort of sashimi. The, you know, outer middle is pink, and that the skin is nice and crispy and burnt. So I'll go with a big slab of grilled wild salmon.
That's a great pick. You know, I don't like seafood. Salmon is the only fish I've ever found really that I enjoy. And the way you were describing that, I wanted to go over to your house and have you make it for me. So.
Next time.
Yeah, let's do that.
I'll be there in July. I'm not going to be in my house. We're house sitting for somebody, but I'm sure they have a grill and we'll definitely do it.
Good stuff. Again, you know, if fish is on the menu, salmon is my go-to. Maybe I need to open myself up. Maybe there's other fish I would enjoy if I'd be a little bit more experimental. I'm going to go with, you know, pizza is an Italian dish. I'm going to go with another Italian dish as my third pick, and that's chicken parm. You know, the great combination of sauce and cheese and breaded chicken. I'm not sure how healthy it is for you because there's a lot of things wrong with what I just said. But when a chicken parm is done right, I can't think of anything more delicious. My favorite restaurant in New England is this place called Mario's in Lexington Center in Massachusetts. And every time I go there, every once in a while I try something different. They have pizza. They have other Italian dishes. I went off the board a couple of times. And I finally said to myself, you know what? the chicken parm never misses here. Why don't I always just get that? Because every time I get it, I'm so glad I got it. I take some of the pasta home. It fills me. The bread there is really good. And the meal is ridiculously inexpensive, too. I wouldn't care if it was expensive. But I go there. I get the Boston Globe, which shows how old I am reading a newspaper, and in print, no less. But chicken parm, when it's done right, I think you can't get anything better than that.
Yeah, I like a good chicken parm, although being gluten-free, again, it's hard to find one that fits the bill, but I have. All right, I'm going to go a little different off the board. There's a lot of good things on my list, but I'm going to go with gelato. I'm in Europe, and there's a lot of Italian gelato places in Portugal. I've been to Rome twice, Milan once. We probably had gelato 5 times every 3 days for the 3-day trips we were there, just to keep trying places and seeing if we could surpass this place, this one place in Lisbon that we go to called Nanarella. And we really couldn't. There were a couple in Rome that were sort of comparable. And these people were originally from somewhere in Italy. I don't know if it was Rome. And it's just it's very simple ice cream. It's a few ingredients. There's no fillers. There's no garbage in it. And great flavors. And they put Italian panna, cream on top. It's not sweet even. It's just like a dollop of it on the top of the ice cream. And the caramel and the hazelnut, chocolate, it's all very good. And I've consumed quite a bit of it, thanks in large part to my 7-year-old daughter, who I use as an excuse to go and pretend I'm doing something nice for her. But really, I greedily partake. So gelato is my next pick.
Yeah, gelato, great pick in the 4th round. I used to have a girlfriend who was big into gelato, and we would go different places. And that's one of the fun things about food is you start comparing, is this place better than this place? And then you find a place that's your high watermark, and then you try to beat it. And then you go back to that place, and maybe it slips a little bit, and you get nervous. Oh, well, maybe they're off their game. Did I go there on the wrong day? But when you catch a right gelato place, you end up going back to a place that slips,
that you swore by, told people, you're like, and it's not that good one day. It's just a horrible feeling. It's like your whole world is, it's like everything you believed is like starting to crumble.
That's how people feel about me, I think. Like, hey, what happened? You used to give me good picks. All of a sudden, you're mediocre. But gelato's a great pick in the 4th round, and I'm sure you're getting a lot of good gelato in your European travels. I'm going to actually pick a healthy food, or presumably a healthy food. I'm sure you'll tell me why it's not healthy. But the thing with me, people say, hey, P&L, get in shape, eat more salads. I actually love salad when it's fresh. If you go with me in a restaurant and I get a salad, if it's good, I will literally clean the plate. I will eat every morsel of salad and dressing, and whatever else is on that plate is gone. But the problem is, salad just seems like a very high variance, hit or miss thing with how fresh are the ingredients. Yeah, I've gone to some restaurants where it seems like usually they have fresh stuff, but I know you're dealing with a cycle. They have a business plan like anybody else. But when a salad is cooked right, I prefer Caesar salads. I like to add a little chicken when I can. But if a salad's just good, I don't care what dressing's on it. If a salad's good, I will eat the whole thing. It's just hard sometimes, high variance food, but I do love me a good salad.
Well, I actually had Greek salad listed here pretty high up. It's probably my favorite kind. And I agree. And I think one thing about food, it's kind of like fruit. People are like, what's your favorite fruit? And the answer for me is always the best kind of any kind. If you eat a good apple, it's like the most delicious thing ever. If you eat a mealy apple, it's gross. It's the same thing with like every kind of fruit. A good piece of almost anything is amazingly good, and a mediocre piece of almost anything is not that good.
There's a bagel place close to me where it's like whatever just came out of the oven is usually the best bagel they have.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same principle. I think almost all this stuff goes without saying, like meat, vegetables, it has to be cooked right. You didn't like steak because, as you said, it wasn't cooked right. So many people don't like foods or think they don't like foods just because they've had like the mediocre version of them. And then they get their eyes open when they taste the real thing. I guess with the last pick, you took salad, which I like salad a lot. I will just go because I love Chinese food so much, but there's so many different things that I'll just go with the simple, the har gao. Those are the shrimp dumplings with rice dumplings, rice noodle dumplings. They're called har gao. It's a type of dim sum. And I'll take that. You know what? I'm going to take 2 things because it's so specific. I'll go with the hot and sour soup also. So I'm going to go Chinese food for my 5th. I grew up in New York and I ate a lot of Chinese food. And then in LA in the San Gabriel Valley, there's some really excellent Chinese food places. Not really inside of LA, but you go to San Gabriel Valley. One is called Szechuan Impression and one is called Chengdu Taste. And so if you're in LA, check those two out.
Yeah, it seems like Chinese food is very regional. I grew up with New England Chinese food and I really liked it. I've been in Michigan for a couple of decades. I've had trouble finding any Chinese food. There's some Thai food I like out here, but there isn't a lot of Chinese that I like. And I find when I go back east, one of the first things I'll do right off the plane, I'll get a rental car and check the hours on my favorite Chinese place and go there. It's almost always one of my first or second stops is to get Chinese food because it's so much different and regional. But yeah, when it's good, it's really good. A couple of things on my board. I was thinking of taking salami and cheese, which is just the best part of an Italian sub. Steak and cheese is another great sub to order. Again, if you want to block your arteries, I'm going to go with scrambled eggs. And this is just a call out to my mom who made great scrambled eggs. My girlfriend makes great scrambled eggs. I don't know why food always seems better when somebody prepares it for me rather than me cooking it myself. I get the idea you might get more satisfaction at cooking your own food, but scrambled eggs have always been a great comfort food for me. It's something I'm comfortable eating any time of day. And if I go to a breakfast place, I may order a few things, but there will be some scrambled eggs on the table.
Yeah, I love cooking. It's relaxing for me. It's easy. It just, I can pretty much, I'll cook for anybody. I also had bacon and eggs on my list. A couple of items. I had Portuguese seafood rice. It's really the only Portuguese food that I like, traditional Portuguese food. And it's really, really good. It's like a seafood rice soup / stew. Fish soup, sausages. I always make sausages on the grill. Good sausages are delicious. Pickles. Beef pho, the Vietnamese soup, Korean beef soup, grilled chicken wings, fried chicken when on the rare occasion I can get gluten-free. And I threw in French fries, obviously. I mean, they're terrible for you, but good French. I mean, everyone loves French fries. And then Thai food. It's really not Thai food that I like. It's Lotus of Siam that I like, the Thai restaurant in Vegas.
Yeah, I've never been there. You guys all sing sonnets about it. I know Dalton loves that place. I know Jeff loves that place. I know Scott Jenstad loves that place. And by the way, shout out to Jeff Erickson. When I picked salad, I should have also pointed out that you don't win friends with salad.
No, he's not. He would have been disappointed if you hadn't added that line.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a blast, Chris. Tell our listeners how they can hang out with Chris Liss.
You can listen to me on XM Monday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 1 Eastern. You can follow me on Twitter at Chris_Liss. And you can listen to a Real Man Wood podcast. We talk about sports. Kind of like this, we go afield and we go very, very far afield into some sort of taboo-ish topics. Again, there, you can follow me at Chris_Liss, and the link to the podcast is on my Twitter account.
Good stuff. And that A Real Man Wood podcast, of course, is with Dalton Del Don, our mutual friend and my Yahoo colleague. And I think he won the staff picks once. It was a long time ago. It's funny. I called you out last year in the staff picks, say, hey, you haven't won it in a while. And after that, you just went torrential. You just went like 2007 Patriots before the Super Bowl on the rest of the league. And you just like smacked. I awakened the giant, it looks like.
You shouldn't have said anything because I was a deep source of embarrassment for me that I hadn't won since like 2006. And it was 2018. And I'm the guy who posted the article.
Right, right.
It's five of us, right? Like I should have won like three times just by luck since then. I hadn't won at all. And it was out there. It wasn't like a secret. Like anyone could see it, but nobody had said anything about it. And it was a deep source of embarrassment. You said it on the air. I had to cop to it. There was no defense. It was, you know, I couldn't hide. And then maybe I should give you credit. I had to step up my game.
You went Tony Robbins. You, again, awakened the giant within.
Yeah.
You absolutely smashed us. And to the point that it was over. I think once the week 17 picks were in, I had no win. I couldn't even go like 16-0. I wasn't going to catch you. So you were, dominant performance there. And who knows, maybe this is going to be a new reign of Chris Liss. Maybe over the next 10 years, you'll go Yankees on us and win seven or eight times.
Stop with the jinx. And by the way, say something embarrassing about my baseball teams, please, right now, too. I could use a boost.
Well, I hope you come back to the Friends and Family League next year. Maybe this is like the fantasy gods looking down on you. Talk about that for a second. Why did we lose you? You were a long time, not only a long time player in the Friends and Family League, you had one of the best records. You play well in the format, just maybe a little bit too intensive, the day-to-day maintenance of any time transaction league.
I would bet that you are probably the only person who has a higher average finish than me in that league since I started it. I love the league. It was a really fun league, and I like the format a lot. And I like the fact that if you have an idea about a player or you're watching a game and you see something, you can act right away. You don't have to wait 4 days for waiver wire. And by that time, the guy's hit three more home runs and everybody's bidding on him. I really like that, but I just wasn't on it enough. And the great thing about Portugal is I can set my lineup and go to sleep. But in that league, you got to be like watching games and ready to pick up guys, and you can't just catch up in the morning on all the games. So that was hurting me a little bit, just only in that one format. And, you know, I travel a lot. And so I just, it'd be like a Saturday and I'd forget to set guys in my lineup and I'd have two home runs on my bench. And it's fine to make a mistake, have the wrong guy in there, but it's not fine to have a blank in there. You know, when you have a guy right on the bench, I mean, that's bad. That happened a bunch of times. And, you know, I have to say it's kind of nice. Like given the leagues that we have, I'm on the hook Sunday night for all my moves, Monday night to set lineups, and Friday for the midweek NFBC setting. And that is it. So I'm freed from the tyranny of stressing about my lineups all the time. It was a tyranny that was great for me for about 12 or 15 years, but I'm actually enjoying the respite.
Yeah, I like the cadence of my fab. I have four leagues that require weekly bids, and they're at 6, 8, 10, and 12 o'clock on Sunday. I love the fact that they're evenly spaced out, and so I get into a cadence every week, and I know what I'm getting into, and there's just the flow of how I make my decisions rather than – and you know what else too? I can't believe I went through life for so long without having a calendar and having reminders for everything and being able to look at a day and say, what am I doing today? What, you know, what do I have to do today, this week? How is it set up? Because for a long time, I didn't do that. I mean, it's only like 10 or 12 years that I've been doing that, and I can't imagine life without it now. Let me just throw one other curveball at you before we get out of here. I mentioned this when we were in the baseball part of the discussion. Did you know that Yahoo Fantasy allows you to pick an end date for your baseball season? You can end it prematurely. Do you think it's a good idea to end a fantasy season, a fantasy baseball season, maybe around when football kicks in, or should we be playing all 6 months?
So I've thought about that. I mean, basketball is even worse, right? I mean, you want to end it sort of the All-Star break if you want to have like a true showing of who should win. And baseball, certainly September 1st, and you can even do August 15th, both because people get distracted and also because, you know, again, analytics, teams tank harder than they ever have. They bring up everybody. They sort of like let everything go. And then it's not a true sense that someone's sort of minor injury September. They don't even put him on the DL. So you're kind of stuck. You can't make the move. You don't really know. But for some reason, I'm a little resistant just because baseball, it's such a statistical sport, whereas the football's head to head. So who cares if you lop off week 17, it's still head to head. You don't really, you're not looking at like, oh, I needed to get 1500 yard season from Gurley. You're just looking at like, well, with Gurley, you lost him in like week 12. But, you know, for a running back, you're not looking at a 1,600-yard season. You're just looking at good scoring every week. Whereas in baseball, you're like, yeah, my guy that I drafted had 40 homers, 20 steals. It was a great year. And if he hits 15 of his homers or 12 of his homers in September, then you only got 28 of them. That kind of sounds – it's just not right for baseball. That year, Brian Dozier hit like 15 of his 40 in late August and September. It's like you didn't get Brian Dozier. You didn't get a lot of his production. So – as tempting as it is, I think baseball is a season-long, stats-based, totals-based game. We look at players from a season-long perspective and what they did. I'd probably leave it as is.
Yeah, I think when I saw that tweak, I thought, oh, this is great. And then I looked at my leagues that I run, and I didn't change anything. I could go with maybe the head-to-head seasons ending a week or two early. I'm fine with that, but I wouldn't do anything significant to the fantasy baseball schedule. But it's nice to have choices. And again, Yahoo Fantasy, the award-winning Yahoo Fantasy app and the award-winning Yahoo Fantasy games. I have nothing to do with any of them other than just talking about them, but I'm really proud of those products. Again, this was a real blast today. I appreciate my guest, Chris Liss. Follow him on Twitter, Chris_Liss. Terrific in our episode 10. Props to Brett Rader, who does not like the Dave Matthews Band. If I have that correctly, he is our producer, keeps us on the air, keeps us sounding good. I am Scott Pianowski. Go rate us on Twitter. Go eat some food, especially off the Chris Liss menu, and maybe you'll get invited to his house someday. We'll have another great guest next week for episode 11. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.